thanks to VS Imports tonight for sponsoring my show. And hello and welcome to Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. I am Erica Wides. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education. And we are broadcasting live tonight from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick. So my show tonight is Salt Part 2. If you were listening last Tuesday night, I did a show on salt and I had a guest who is a charcuterie and salumi expert. And we were talking about salt, and we really sort of started off with the history of salt and how humans sought it out because it's so crucial to our survival, and how we used to get salt from eating wild animals, but then as we cultivated animals, we had to begin to seek out our salt. And we really covered all the history last week. We didn't really have that much time to get into technique. So because this show is Why We Cook, I want to talk about why we cook and why we cook with salt and why we use it. And then a little bit later on in the show, I'll have a guest on who is Clayton Lank, and he is the founder of a company called Quaddy Mist Sea Salt, which is a sea salt producing company in Maine, and they're one of the very few remaining sea salt producers in Maine. Maine used to have a pretty big salt producing industry, and it died off with the fisheries industry, and he's reviving it. So we'll have him on a little bit later. But what I want to talk about, you know, now is how we use salt in cooking and why we use it for cooking. We talked about a lot about the history last time, but what you really have to think about is, other than it being an absolute medical necessity for us to eat salt, salt is really critical for introducing flavor in food. It's a chemical flavor enhancer. So what salt does is it raises the bar of all the other flavors that are served along with it. It acts chemically along with other flavors to elevate them. It sort of raises the profile of all the other flavors in your food. And it's the only food that we purely taste because it has no smell. It's the only one that is purely based on taste and not smell. So it's pretty unique in that sense. And we add it to our food because it elevates the flavor. It's not that we're necessarily looking for saltiness. What we're looking for is a more complex, rounded flavor. And you'd understand this if you ever accidentally bought something like unsalted pretzels or unsalted potato chips or unsalted bread. They don't taste like food. They taste like anti-food. They taste like the opposite of food in a way without the salt. It's like a void. Something's really missing. So as a cook, knowing how to use salt and how to season food is really the key to coaxing out the best in the ingredients that you're using, not only as a professional cook, but as a home cook. Now, professionally, we really like to use salt in cooking because it's how we make food taste really good. It's why restaurant food generally tastes better than home cooking, because we use so much, not so much salt, but we know how to use it correctly. And some of the best meals I've ever had in my life have been nothing but really, really perfect fresh ingredients, minimally altered with just a little bit of olive oil and some few flakes of sea salt. Really some of the best things I've ever eaten have really been that simple. And that's what's so important about salt. So when you put salt into food, what does it do? Well, first thing, it really balances out acid. So if you combine salt with an acid, they balance each other out. They play off of each other, salt and lemon juice, salt and vinegar. They really balance each other out. It also really diminishes bitterness in flavors. So it really will tone down bitterness in things like that have really dark kind of undercurrents of bitterness. If you pair it with cocoa, if you pair it with coffee flavors, it'll tame the bitterness in those, or naturally occurring bitter flavors, undertones in food. And it rounds out flavors. If you were sort of to, you know, visualize a flavor in your brain, you know, sort of think of it as a shape, when you add salt, it becomes three-dimensional and it rounds it out. So a really good example of that is if you make a chocolate sauce. If you take, you know, bittersweet chocolate and melt it with some cream and add a little bit of sugar, it'll taste really good just like that. But if you add the tiniest bit of salt to it, it'll actually round out the impression of sweetness. So it becomes less about a one-dimensional cloying sweetness and much more of a three-dimensional rounded sweet flavor. It's almost like music. It gives depth and complexity to it. And it also plays down some of the bitter notes in the chocolate. So that's a really perfect example of pairing chocolate with salt. You know, if you've ever had a chocolate-covered pretzel, that's the perfect example of how well those two play together. And Well, we're talking about sweet things. In Brittany, in France, the cows that graze on the grass along the coast in Brittany have saltier milk because the grass that they're eating is infused with salt spray. And so the Bretons will take the cream from that salty milk and they'll cook it down in caramelized sugar and they'll make caramel from it. And it's a salty caramel. So you have the creaminess and the saltiness and the complexity of the caramelized sugar that makes these amazing, incredible sea salt caramels. And then they'll put a few flakes of sea salt on top of that. And to me, they're, you know, the confectionery version of crack. Not that I would know from personal experience, but if you were going to make candy that was the same as crack, that's what it would be. But getting away from dessert, another thing that happens is that, you know, animals, if they eat a lot of salt, it seasons their meat. So in Brittany, in places with a lot of salty coastal land, the meat takes on that flavor. And so in the coastal areas of France where they raise lamb, especially in southern France, they eat a lamb that's called pré-salé lamb. It's pre-salted. And some chefs love it, and some chefs think it tastes a little bit too much like fish. So it's kind of a preference thing there. But, you know, you are what you eat, and animals are what they eat. And so if the animal eats a lot of salt, the meat will take on salty overtones. But if you're eating meat that's not raised in a salty area, not grazing on salty grass, you, of course, have to learn how to season it properly. And so that brings us to how to use salt to season meat and how to properly season meat when you're cooking it. So the really basic rule breaks down to when you salt meats for cooking, you either want to do it just before you cook, seconds before it goes in the pan, or several hours ahead. The difference is that if you salt the meat ahead, the salt draws moisture to the surface of the meat and makes it wet. And that's okay if you're doing it hours in advance, because it'll actually help to sort of marinate the meat and it'll help to tenderize it and it'll change the structure and the texture of the meat a little bit. But if you're salting the meat and you let it sit for a few minutes, it's going to get wet on the surface. And then if you try to saute it or to roast it or to sear it, you're going to have wet protein. And wet protein doesn't brown, because you can't brown the surface of it if there's water on it. So you'll get steam and not browning. So it's really important, A, to dry proteins off before you attempt to saute them or brown them, but B, to dry them and then salt them and then immediately put them in the pan. So if you're going to be cooking proteins or cooking a meat, the rule to remember is you either do it right before it's going in the pan or several hours before you're going to cook it. So we're going to take a very short break here. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about brining and what brining can do to vegetables or can do to proteins. And then we'll talk a little bit about vegetables and what salt does to vegetables too. So we'll be back in just a few seconds. You're listening to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I want to thank VS Imports tonight for sponsoring the show, especially to Donato, who donated the wine that we get to drink tonight in the studio. Very nice benefit of being here tonight. So we were talking about salting proteins in the last segment, and you can salt your proteins right before you cook them. You can salt them a few hours in advance, or you can actually brine them. And brining is a process of soaking meats in a salt solution. And people have been doing this for thousands and thousands of years. Basically, what happens is if you put a protein into a salt solution, you have osmosis begin to occur with the cells of the meat. If you remember back to high school and learning about osmosis, the brine, because of all the salt in it, puts pressure on the cells and it pushes its way through the cell wall, drains the water out of the cell and replaces the moisture in the cell with brine. So the brine adds juiciness. So if you bite into a pork tenderloin or a piece of turkey or something that's been brined, you're going to get much more of an illusion of juiciness or a perception of juiciness. So it's great to use for really lean proteins, things like pork tenderloins or turkeys, you know, especially if you're buying, God forbid, you would buy industrially raised meat that tends to be very dry, but sometimes you can't avoid it. And brines are just really basic. It's a basic ratio. Generally, you do 2-to-1 salt to sugar. Dissolve it in water. Make sure it's cold before you put the protein in it. And you can add seasoning, spices, beer, herbs, really whatever you want to it. And keep it cold while you are brining. And the term corned beef, just a little culinary history here. Corned beef comes from corning beef. And corning was the process of soaking in a brine because the salt used to come in big pieces that were the size of little grains of corn. And it was called corn salt. So if you're ever on Jeopardy, you can use that one. So now let's take a little leap to vegetables, to what salt can do to vegetables. Salt does the same kind of thing with vegetables. It basically penetrates the cell wall and it drains the water out of it. It makes them collapse. So vegetables get softer when you add salt to them. So a really good example of that is cabbage. If you're making a slaw, if you shred up cabbage and you toss it with salt and you let it sit for a while, it's going to become softer. It's going to basically chemically wilt and it becomes much more palatable. So often slaw recipes will call for salting cabbage. And sauerkraut is just cabbage that's been shredded and tossed with salt, but then it's left to ferment in its own juices because cabbage has naturally occurring yeast and bacteria on the surface. And if you mix that cabbage with salt and get it really juicy, it'll start to develop its own brine. And you let it sit, those naturally occurring yeasts and bacteria will start to ferment. They start to create acetic acid, which is vinegar. And because the salt is in there, the salt kind of slows down all the nasty bacteria that could happen in there. You leave it for about 3 weeks and you have sauerkraut. That's what sauerkraut is. It's pretty simple. And sauerkraut and all the other forms of it, forms of pickled salted cabbage like kimchi, are real survival foods in cultures that have cold winters because cabbage is really high in vitamin C. So for a lot of colder northern climates, from eastern France all the way across, all the way to Asia and all the way up to Korea, cabbage and pickled cabbage and fermented cabbage was a real survival food for winter. It's how people got their vitamin C in the era before the shipment of citrus from warmer climates. And a little bit later in the summer, I'll have a guest on who is an old student of mine, Young Sun Lee, and he has a restaurant called Persimmon. And he's Korean, and he makes a lot of his own kimchi, and we're going to have him on talk about kimchi, too. So anyway, back to vegetables. The word salad, of course, comes from the root for salt, because the ancient Romans liked to sprinkle their raw greens and their raw herbs with salt and just eat them that way. So salad is based in that root for salt. Like on Passover, when we take our bitter herbs and dip them in salt water to represent tears, it's the same kind of idea. But if you're serving fresh salad greens, you should salt them right before you serve because salt pulls moisture out of food and it'll cause wilting. So if you're making a slaw with something crunchy like cabbage, that's great. But if you're using delicate lettuce and you want them to stay crispy, salt should go on right before. If you salt sliced tomatoes before you serve them and let them sit for a while, the salt will actually enhance the flavor of the tomatoes. As it draws out moisture, it also creates kind of an intensely salty, tomato-y flavored juice on the surface. And we actually call that tomato water. You can drain that off and serve it as a clear kind of a consommé in a way. And the salt also balances out the sweetness and the acidity of the tomatoes. So salt is kind of the missing element with tomatoes. You have sweetness and you have acidity and you add salt in there and it really makes that tomato flavor just explode. And of course, eggplant is often salted. People like to salt their eggplant before they cook it, because they believe that it draws out the bitterness in the eggplant. Well, not many eggplants are very bitter anymore. Most of the modern hybrids that we eat aren't bitter, but what the salt does is it makes the eggplant less spongy and more porous, or less spongy, sorry, and less porous, so that when you cook it, it just doesn't absorb as much oil. And that's really the benefit to salting eggplant before you cook it, is that it'll become less porous and it won't suck up oil like a sponge, which eggplant tends to do. You've probably never seen raw olives sold in a supermarket or in a specialty market because you can't eat them raw. They're completely inedible raw. They actually have to be soaked in brine first to be cured. So olives are a good example of a vegetable that relies on salt to become palatable. I'm sure, you know, the first few hundred people who tasted raw olives off the tree thought about how useless this crop was that they came upon and figured out eventually that if they put them in some salt water, it would take out the bitter compounds and they become palatable and they become delicious. And jumping from vegetables, we can talk a little bit about eggs. When you are poaching an egg, you always put a little bit of acid in the water, usually vinegar, because it helps to form up the proteins, helps to firm them up. But if you put a little bit of salt in there too, that'll help to kind of tighten up the shape also and keep your egg a little bit more compact. If you're hard boiling or hard cooking an egg, you put a little salt in the water. And if you have any kind of hairline cracks in the eggshell, it'll keep the white from feathering out into the water. But if you're whipping egg whites, if you want to make a meringue or you're making something with whipped egg whites or folding them into a souffle, you never want to put salt into your whipped egg whites because it inhibits the volume. It makes those proteins less able to stretch out and encapsulate air. It'll also cause dryness. So don't add salt to your whipped egg whites. Of course, when you whip egg whites, often you want to whip them in a copper bowl. And the best way to clean the copper bowl, ironically, is with a little bit of salt and some vinegar. And that polishes your copper bowl, but make sure you rinse that out really well. And if you have copper pots at home and you want to polish them, the best thing you can use is salt and vinegar. Or what's really great is using pickle juice, because that's what pickle juice is. So if you have an empty jar of pickles, but a jar full of juice, you can use that to polish your copper pots. So you get household hints on this show, too. It's not just about cooking. I'm like the Heloise of the Heritage Network. So one more little vegetal note is that if you're cooking beans, now there's some debate about this in the food science world, but if you're cooking beans, if you add salt to your beans, it'll change the texture and you'll get kind of a mealier texture to your beans and not so much of a creamy texture. So usually we add salt at the end of cooking beans. You also never want to put any acid in with your beans, because it slows that down a lot too. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about fish and about sea salt. And we'll have our guest on, Clayton Link from Quaddy Mist. And we'll be right back on Why We Cook. Welcome back to Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored tonight by VS Imports, and we want to thank Donato for donating wine. And with us on the phone now, we have Clayton Lank from Quaddy Mist Sea Salt in Maine. Hi, Clayton. Are you there? No? Do we have Clayton yet?
Can you speak up for me?
Sure. We have Clayton Lank joining us on the phone from Quaddy Mist Sea Salt. Are you there, Clayton? No? Okay. Well, when we get Clayton on, we'll talk to him. But in the meantime, let's talk about what salt does to fish, because we're going to be talking about sea salt, so we'll talk about fish. So if you think about eating something like a gravlax or a smoked salmon, those are fish that have been transformed.
Hey,
oh, hi, you're there. Oh, good. How are you? Hello? Clayton, are you there? Hi, can you hear me? No. Okay. So we were talking about fish, and if you think about something like gravlax or smoked salmon, that's fish that has been transformed by the addition of salt. If you take a side of fish, side of salmon, and you coat it with a dry salt mixture, salt and sugar and some herbs, and you leave it for a few days, you'll have something called gravlax. The salt and sugar get in there, they pull out the moisture, dehydrate the fish, and it gives you that supple kind of silky, velvety texture that we associate with cured fish. So it's pretty amazing. And for smoked salmon, the sides of salmon are brined before they're smoked. And the same thing happens. The brine draws out the water, and it also really minimalizes the bacterial growth. Then the salmon is smoked, and the smoke creates basically a toxic film on the surface of the fish, which prevents the bacteria from landing. So it preserves the fish. Okay, do we have Clayton with us now? You there? Yes?
Speak really loud.
Okay, Clayton, are you there? Can you hear me now? Nope, I'm not getting him. Okay, so let's go back to talking about fish. We're having some technical issues tonight. So we're still on the subject of fish and what salt does to fish and preparation of fish. And this is one that I find really interesting. If you're a big sushi fan, which I am, and you eat a lot of sushi, what
hi,
you want?
Erica.
Oh, hi, you're there.
Yes, we're here.
Okay, good. Sorry, we were having some trouble getting you there. So we have Clayton on the line now. And Clayton, you're the owner, proprietor of Quadi Mist Sea Salt?
That is correct.
Okay, and you guys are in Lubeck, Maine, right?
Lubeck, Maine.
As far north as you can go in Maine before you hit Canada.
As far as northeast as you can go, yes.
Yeah. So tonight on the show, we're talking about salt. And last week I did a show sort of on the history of salt. And tonight I'm doing a show on how we use it in cooking and how salt affects food. And I remembered that I had this jar of Quadi Mist salt that somebody had brought me back from visiting your facility, and I thought it was great, so it seemed to make sense to have you on the show. Do you want to give us a little sense of where the salt industry is in Maine, how you came to be a part of it, what it used to be, what it is now?
The salt industry in Maine, compared to years ago, is a small industry. It is beginning to grow again as compared to what it was back in the 1800s. There is probably two local producers that produce the gourmet sea salts. And basically they are all, you know, for the specialty food, specialty table.
Uh-huh. So it's sea salt that you, it's evaporated sea salt?
Yes, it's evaporated seawater.
So do you use pans? Do you flood? How does it work?
We flood tables. It's mm-hmm. all done inside here.
Mm-hmm.
It's all done inside. We flood tables, and it's evaporated down on the tables.
Uh-huh. So in the last century, you know, ages ago, when there was a lot of sea salt production there, it was because of the fish canning industry, too, right? There was such a need for salt in the region.
Yes. Back in the 1800s, early 1900s, the sardines, they used the sea salt to pack the sardines and preserve the sardines.
Mm-hmm.
The sea salt was also used in mustards. Mm-hmm. That was actually used in the sardines. It used for pickle herring, salt cod, salt
right.
pollock.
Right. And so there was a natural demand for it right there, and it was all kind of self-contained, the industry.
Yes, it was.
Right. And now there's no more fish cannery industry really in Maine at all,
no,
is there?
No, the fish cannery business is gone.
Right. It's sort of like Cannery Row on the West Coast, the same idea. I think the fish became very overfished, and a lot of the industry went offshore, right, to other countries, and that was kind of the end of it. So how did you wind up in the sea salt industry?
This is something we picked up. I was, when I came, left college, a gentleman actually requested that I help him start making sea salt
mm-hmm.
because of my history of producing value-added products.
Mm-hmm.
And we started doing this together, and he lasted about 6 months, and he didn't think it would work, so he actually walked away from it.
Oh.
And I picked it up from there and started producing basically just the plain gourmet sea salt that was high in trace minerals and low in sodium. And we went from there to and expanded out into the different sea vegetable blends and the different gourmet chef blends.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's the one I have with sea vegetable in it, which I love. I love mm-hmm. that the combination of like the nori and the salt together. I like to grind it to a powder and put it on popcorn. It's really good that way. So are you sold nationally? How do you market? Do you sell online? How do you guys market your product?
A lot of our product is sold online on our website at quadimist.com.
Mm-hmm.
We do sell. We use sell through Fuji's out on the West Coast. We do sell through Whole Foods stores in New England.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, we started out as a Maine company selling sea salt to Maine tourism and specialty stores in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And other shops have continuously, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years, kept picking us up.
Mm-hmm. So business is good. Business is growing.
It is growing,
yeah. It's great. Yeah, I mean, there's such a demand now, I think, for not just sea salt, but really interesting salts and salts with a provenance, you know, salts that come from somewhere. And, you know, chefs are very familiar with the French sea salts, the fleur de sel, and you know, the gray salts and the Maldon salt from England. But I think it's really nice to know that we are now domestically producing, again, our own sea salt.
Yes, we are. And if you look on the parallel, we're on the same parallel as the Brittany.
Sure, right.
Salt ponds. So
right, so it's the same idea. Same ocean. Same salt. Right. Earlier in the show, we were talking about the lamb and the cattle in Brittany that feed on the grass that is, you know, washed in salt spray, and how their meat has a natural affinity for that. Yeah. So if people want to purchase the salt, where can they? They can go right to your website, to Quaddy Mist.
They can go right to the website. Mm-hmm. At www.quaddymist.com, and Quaddy Mist is spelled QUODDYMIST.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. All right, well, we're going to move along here, and I was talking about how salt affects fish. I was, when we were having some technical trouble there, I was getting into talking about sushi and using salt in sushi. So if you want to hang out and join in the conversation, you can stay on the line and join in with us.
We'd love to do that.
Okay, great. So what I was actually about to get to is that in sushi making, you know, generally people think of salt as something, I mean, as fish for sushi is something, you know, pulled right out of the sea, raw and fresh, cut it open and eat it. But actually, a lot of the fish that we eat in sushi has been treated with salt. And that is to kill parasites. And one of them particularly is mackerel. And mackerel is one of those fish, too, that I think used to be primarily canned. And people only think of it as something that was canned along with the herring and the sardines. They're all, you know, kind of in the same family. And mackerel is a fish that can have a really nasty parasite called Anisakis. Did you ever hear of that?
Yes.
Yeah, so you know about the Anisakis poisoning. But salt will actually kill it. And so mackerel for sushi is treated with salt and vinegar and left to cure, and then that kills the parasite, and then the mackerel is served up. So when you're eating your sushi, you're not eating raw mackerel. It's actually been treated with that. How did you know about Anisakis, just from your connection with fish and salt?
With fish and fisheries, basically.
Fish and fisheries, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a pretty nasty parasite, although it's not fatal. I guess you can recover from it. But also sushi-grade salmon. And, you know, up there in Maine, you guys have a lot of salmon farming now, too, right? And your sort of inland salmon farming industry has kind of taken off. I know some people who have a salmon farm somewhere on the main coast, but it's the same with sushi grade salmon, that it has to be salted and vinegar too, or flash frozen right to sub-zero temperatures.
Yeah.
In order to make it edible, because, you know, it's a fish that spends some time in fresh water, and a lot of people don't know this, but you never ever want to eat a freshwater fish raw, because they're just teeming with parasites.
Yeah
So sushi grade salmon is often treated with salt and vinegar, or it's flash frozen. And now, do you sell industrially too? Do you sell to any of the existing canneries or to salted, you know, fish producers, or are you really more just table salt now?
It's basically table salt. We do supply a couple of ingredient companies that use it as an ingredient in their products,
like in their blends, or
yes, in different blends.
And how much do you produce? I mean, I have no sense of sort of how much water is needed to produce how much salt. What's the ratio?
It's a lot like the maple syrup, and the seawater here takes about 40 gallons in order to make about 3 pounds of salt.
So what, how do you fuel it? What's the, you know, where does the power come from? Because it's not solar evaporation, right? Because you do it inside.
No, we can't. It's hard to do on this coast. It's hard to do solar.
So Maine.
Humidity is very high here, and we don't get the sunlight. So a lot of, we use heat, basically.
And what's the fuel source?
Right now we're using a oil-fired furnace.
Oil-fired furnace.
Yeah.
Wow. It would be interesting if you could figure out a way to use sort of like fish oil, you know, bio-oil.
Yeah.
But
I think the ultimate way to go is for us is, in the long range, is going to be windmill and electrical.
Sure. That makes sense. Or hydroelectric, too, I suppose,
yes.
You know, with the power of the tides up there. Yeah,
those
cold main waves. Yeah, yeah, great. All right. Well, let's get back to our subject of sushi, because people may not also know this, that when you're eating sushi rice, the rice has also been seasoned with salt and sugar and rice vinegar. And that serves two purposes. The first one is it just makes the rice really delicious. Do you guys get a lot of sushi up there in Lebec?
Not a lot of sushi here. We have to go to New York. We want sushi.
Right. Or to Portland. Maybe you can go to Portland. You know. But adding the salt and sugar and the rice vinegar to the rice makes it really good. But of course, it also changes the pH of the rice. And pH is what, you know, balances out acids and alkalines. And if you change the pH of the rice, you make it much more safe to be used at room temperature. And sushi rice should be served sort of room temperature to actually body temperature. Sushi chefs like the rice to be right around body temperature. And that's like the perfect medium for growing bacteria. You know, you're asking for trouble if you leave plain warm rice sitting out. So by adding salt to it, adding the rice vinegar, you're changing the pH of the rice. And you're basically knocking out the bacteria that could cause foodborne illness. So it's definitely something you want to do. If you're making your own sushi, you don't want to just use plain rice. You have to season it. And a vegetable actually probably grows really well up there in Maine, which is daikon, which is this big radish. It's a cold weather vegetable. Daikon is always shredded up and served with sushi and with sashimi. And it's not just because it's a garnish. It's because it actually has antibacterial properties also. And you should eat that with the fish in case there's any parasites or bacteria lingering on the fish. The daikon will actually help to kill those. So, you know, salt not only serves all those purposes as a food seasoning and as a flavor enhancer, but it's also this sort of great antibacterial and foodborne illness ingredient that we can use too. And I'm sure you know, did you major in some sort of food science? Is that how you became familiar with all this stuff? Oh, hello? Oh, all right. Well, I guess we lost Clayton, but I'll finish up with what I'm talking about. With
we hear you again here now.
Oh, you're back? Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we're just about finished here, but we're just going to get into a couple other things, too. And one is the use. And can you stay on with us, Clayton? Are you all right?
Yeah.
Or do you
nope,
need to?
No, we're fine.
Okay. So we'll just keep going. So, now, you guys just make basic salt, you know, for use for the table and blends and for people to sprinkle on. But there's this whole culture, too, of salted fermented seasonings that people have used for thousands of years. Things like fish sauce and soy sauce and miso and shrimp paste, which are condiments that people use, not necessarily before they had refined salts, but along with it. And these are all fermented products that came from the effort to preserve fish or soybeans or rice by using salt because it has these great preservative qualities. So products that we think of like soy sauce, fish sauce, shrimp paste, miso all came out of that effort to preserve by using salt. And all of them are also super high in something that we call umami. And you use nori in your salt blend, right, in your sea vegetable blend, nori seaweed. Hello? Nope, he's gone. Okay. So nori is a seaweed. It comes from the ocean, and it's what this Quatimist sea salt uses. And nori seaweed and fermented fish and fermented soybeans all have something in them called umami. And umami is considered like the fifth taste. It's this very meaty, complex richness. And it comes from free glutamic acid, free glutamates that naturally occur in certain foods. And so it's why if you eat something like a soy sauce or a miso or fish sauce, you're not only getting the saltiness, but you're getting this kind of mouth-filling, really rich flavor too. And that's from these naturally occurring glutamates. And that sense of that like rich meatiness was identified about 100 years ago by a Japanese scientist and realized that it was naturally occurring glutamates, glutamic acid. So he went into the lab and synthesized it, and that's where monosodium glutamate comes from, which people don't think of as necessarily a positive ingredient or additive in foods. But all of those fermented products that are based on salt and proteins come from that. They're really high in that. And that's what umami is. It's this fifth taste. And the free glutamate that is in umami is actually a key component in brain-building proteins. So it's something that we need, and it's something that people kind of seek out in food because it's good for us and it's natural. And it adds that really rich flavor to us. So all of those ingredients, the fish sauce and the shrimp paste and miso, they add flavor to salt, but they also add much, much more to your food. They add a lot of complexity. They add depth. They add like a roasted caramelly flavor. They add sweetness. It's a really nice way to add more complexity, more to food than just using straight up salt. And fish sauce, of course, is really my favorite one of them, and it's made from anchovies and salt. And the anchovies have been fermented and mixed with water and put in a barrel, and then the liquid gets drained off. The anchovies are salted and fermented, and then the liquid's drained off, and that's what fish sauce is. And fish sauce is a key ingredient in Southeast Asian cooking in places like Thailand and Vietnam. And not only is it sort of this delicious salty condiment, but it's because it's made from anchovies, it's very high in protein. It's also really high in umami. So it's very meaty, rich flavored, and it's really a key ingredient in Southeast Asian cooking. It's used extensively in Thailand, Vietnam, the Philippines. In the same way that soy sauce is used in Northern Asia, they use fish sauce in Southeast Asia. And speaking of Vietnam, I will be heading off to Vietnam for a month starting this week. So I'll be going there to teach in a program called Streets International. And Streets International is an organization that takes street kids off the streets, houses them, educates them, and trains them to work in the hospitality industry. We teach them to work in restaurants and hotels, get them jobs, get them back on their feet, you know, give them really good lives and marketable skills. So Streets is building a restaurant in a town called Hoi An in Vietnam, and I'm going there to help them to launch that. So if you want to learn more about that, you can go to streetsinternational.org and read about the foundation and read about what we'll be doing there. And I'll be eating a lot of fish sauce while I'm there, hopefully. I love Vietnamese food. But that's about all the time we have for tonight on our second edition of Salt, the sequel. So that's about all we have time for. And I want to thank Clayton. I think we lost him before, but we'll thank him for that. And if you want to check out his salt, it's quadimist.com. And I recommend the sea salt and seaweed, sea vegetable blend. So that's it for tonight for Why We Cook. Thanks for joining us. We're on the Heritage Radio Network. And I just want to thank VS Imports one more time for sponsoring the show tonight. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.